said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with a very good and long-term friend of mine and of INET, Mr. Yida Chow, who is based in Shanghai and works at the Shanghai Development Research Foundation. He has spent time in the United States, in part was educated at the Kennedy School. He's worked with New York companies like MetLife, New York Life. He's worked a lot in China, and he now works with a non-government, what we call NGOs, non-government organization foundation. And I've had the pleasure of working with him both at INET conferences and at many events in his country that he's helped me to get invitation to and to speak at or be a discussant. So, well, thanks for joining me tonight, Yidi. We come together to speak at a time where there are many, many challenges in the world, as we know with the pandemic and the issues of racial discrimination that were underscored by the hideous death of George Floyd. We're seeing very, very distorted macroeconomic behavior and all kinds of emergency bailouts. But at the core, with climate on the horizon, with a global system that must cooperate in many dimensions, I think the most daunting concern might well be the state and the deterioration of the U.S.-China relationship. So I'm curious how you see what's unfolding, why it's unfolding, how did we get here, and then as we move on tonight, we can talk about what constructive things we can do about it. But for right at the start, what do you see happening that has caused so much consternation, so much concern and anxiety about the future of U.S. and China's relationship?
Okay, Bob, very nice to be with you again. As you describe, we worked together for many events in the past. Mm-hmm. Also, yes. As you describe, I in some way get educated in U.S., although I was born and grew up in Shanghai in China. So
yes.
China is my motherland. U.S. also very close to my heart. So obviously, when I look at the current escalation of tension between U.S. and China, I feel very sad and sorry about that. What will happen in past several years, from 30 or 40 years ago, these two countries get together in engagement until now, almost go to someone called Cold War. I want to quote the one judgment from Susan Shook, who was former state official, currently is the director of a China Research Center under University of San Diego. She summarized for that as an overreach and overaction, which means in China, maybe sometime overseas, they do something a little bit overreach, while U.S. response to that, from her point, is overaction. That's something describe what happened until 1970, Trump administration take regime. So from 2017 to 2019, these 2 years, the relation between U.S.-China get worse, but most time both sides focus on negotiation, on trade deal. And the result, the first race of trade agreement reached under the end of 2019, the signing ceremony was held in January this year. That's the stage. Although some the conflict occur, but most time, most focus on the negotiation of trade deal. But now the things happen. Since the outbreak of a pandemic, the relation between these two countries in almost every area, diplomatic, ideological, military, get worse to worse. That's something I feel very, very sorry about that. Of course, during the 2017 to 2019, U.S. defined the relation between, defined China as a strategic competitor. But actually, they treat China like an enemy, particularly in past several months. So that's the situation. I very much concerned about that.
Do you see ways in which China could adjust to reassure the United States, or do you think the United States is now just too emotional, wound up, anxious about the pandemic in a presidential election year, and there's no, which you might call, no gesture that is dignified that helps the situation improve?
From my perspective, I think there are two fundamental issues U.S. and China facing. For U.S., they have to make decision whether they allow another big economy like China peacefully rising. Of course, China has a different social system, different economic model, different ideology. But at the same time, China wouldn't enforce their lifestyle to any other countries. That's something different from Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
That's fundamental decision have to be made by U.S. For China side, yes, China get lots of benefit from their integration to global system, particularly in economically and financially. But the issue or question China have to face, have to make decision whether they have to fully integrate into global system. I mean, in other area, for example, regulation, some concept, some rule-based law. I want to quote one legal tycoon in China. His name called Jiang Ping. Once he publicly said, I guess 5 or 6 years ago, in some conference, he said China should go for the world title, not against world title. I understand that what he means, word title, is democracy, market, internationalization, these kind of things. I very much like his philosophy under that, because first of all, you have to have a correct direction. Secondly, you don't necessarily copy everything in the Western country. You have your own history. You have your own cultural background. But the general direction have to be same with the most country in the world. I guess these two fundamental issues for both countries have to think it over. Otherwise, the detail, it's harder to resolve the detail for individual issue until they make decision on the fundamental issue I just described for each country. Later on, it will be easier to solve technically some detailed issue.
Mm-hmm. And so, in essence, instead of thinking of all that is big and daunting and intimidating, to break things into pieces and show step-by-step progress to heal the differences would make more sense.
As I describe, fundamental issues have to resolve first. Second step, as you describe, we have to find some way to mitigate the tension or improve the relationship. I guess maybe some approach can be taken. Three approaches can be taken. First of all, both sides can find some area which can be coordinated or cooperated. For example, how to deal the nuclear issue of North Korea, how to deal with terrorists, how to deal climate change, etc., something more than that. That's the first area we can do. Second area, we can, both sides, even including NGO like you and us, which area both sides have dispute or debate, we identify whether we can reach some compromise on these issues, find that these issues can be reached compromising. The third area, if we do find some area cannot really reach agreement, but at least we can find a way control these contradictions, not to explore to some degree totally out of control. I guess these three level or three approach maybe is the way for both sides to go further, as you describe, in constructive way. That's my thinking.
Well, like sometimes just small victories give you more confidence to go on to bigger challenges. And you can't just jump all the way, we say, across the ocean. You have to swim a little bit and then work your way towards the bigger problems. So let's talk about questions related to trade, which is the one that I guess is always on the surface, but maybe is not the essence of where the differences lie. But on trade, the Americans complain that their strongest sector, the technology sector, is barred from China. the Chinese talk about the role of what you might call cybersecurity and intelligence gathering as distinct from digital commerce. And we're finding out more about that in the United States. I think that the Chinese have shown a great deal of insight into the, what you might call side effects or externalities. There are questions related to intellectual property rights. I remember many Americans were very upset when the China 2025 plan came out because it looked as though China, in the next phase of development, wanted to excel by replacing things that the Western countries like Germany and the United States were already good at, which is a natural ambition. But people were startled that it was announced so quickly. But China's been moving fast. It's very sophisticated. You're investing a lot in research and so forth. So I can see where some of the concerns are. The other thing is many American companies, going back to even 1972 with Pepsi and Coca-Cola, always wanted to go have enormous marketplace access in China. The economies of scale of selling Pepsi to 1.25 billion people was something that American executives used to glow about as a fantasy. And the idea that they go to China and then somebody else makes very good cola under a Chinese name and they never get the market share makes them frustrated. So these are just stories that I have heard about how, in essence, the Western companies did not get enough access. And then the second piece, and you mentioned this in your earlier comment, China has a different organizational philosophy about the role of the state. And many people are afraid that with the assistance of the state, Chinese companies have an added advantage that Western companies don't have. And I mean, after we've seen all the bailouts, it's hard to say the Western companies don't get those advantages. But their idea was one as a private sector and one as a mixed system. And I've never heard Chinese leaders say they want to give up the mixed system, but I've heard a lot in the West be afraid of how competitive Chinese firms would be overseas if they had access to government support, particularly in troubled times. But I'm just painting pictures here. What do you think in the realm of trade were the areas that were the most difficult to, or caused the most disruption here?
Okay, thank you for your very comprehensive description on the trade issue. First of all, I want to just focus on the first phase of a trade agreement just reached by the end of last year, signed in January this year. From some Chinese economists think that China give up too much, because if you look at the item of the agreement, always say what China should do, very little ask China the Americans should do. But anyway, generally, the first phase of deal is, as you described, just very surface, not essential, because basically only ask China purchase more products from U.S., particularly buy more pharma products. But That's the very simple summarize. As the treatment of American company in China, I guess you are right. The system in China, in some way, not only unfavorable to foreign company, actually unfavorable to private company, Chinese private company. Also, the reason is that you look at the history. China originally is public ownership on everything on the base economy, planning economy. Things start 40 years ago, China moved step by step to more market oriented. Of course, during this process, sometimes, as I described, go for the two step, then get back one step. These kind of things always happen. So some concern of American company, I think, are legitimate. But for the plan 2025 actually is copy of German. They call New Industry 4.0. Of course, this plan may be favorable to Chinese company in some way, bias against a foreign company. That's true. I guess I have to say Chinese government, I guess, at least start to recognize that's the issue. But, you know, I'm the independent director for one private company, China. Personally, I know private company, a Chinese private company, sometimes harder to get a loan from bank, harder to get the high rating if they want to issue the bond. Why the system is naturally favorable to stay on? Because if you are the rating company, if you are the renter, probably you naturally you want to make a loan to state-owned company. Why? If the loan fails, you can ask the government to pay. So that's the system, the problem. Mm-hmm. I understand that. That's something have to be resolved in China. I can give you some example. 2 years ago, in Indonesia, there's a G20 summit. The Yi Gang, the governor of the PBOC, publicly mentioned China should take neutrality, competition neutrality, the principle. Later on, next year, the Premier Li Keqiang, in his government report, also he emphasized competition neutrality. Last year, personally, I got an invitation to attend a joint conference between Central Bank of China, PBOC, and the IMF in Beijing. The title is competition neutrality. But unfortunately, later on, we find that these terms disappear in Chinese official document. I don't know why, I just guess some corner internally disagree with that. So what I try to describe, just like everywhere, they have an internal struggle on something. Maybe sometime go for the one step, back two step. But one thing also I can point out, just 1 or 2 weeks ago, President Xi Jinping organized the conference, organized the meeting for all of entrepreneurship, entrepreneurial businessmen. It's the first time invite 3 foreign company representatives to attend. Of course, it's only symbolic. It's not essential, but at least it's sign they want to move to correct direction. That's something I can share with you.
Mm-hmm. So in the history, there was a time when Kissinger and Nixon came to see Mao. And the systems were very different.
Yeah.
I know there was a pressure on the United States in its competition with the Soviet Union. But there was what you might call an enthusiasm about collaboration between these two very different systems. I would say since that time, meaning from 1972 to, 48 years later, the systems are still different, but they're closer than they were. And yet, someone like Orville Schell, who you and I both know, with the Asia Society U.S.-China program that he runs and works on climate issues between California and China, many things. Well, he's just written an article called The End of Engagement, where the engagement began in 1972, and it, ceased to exist at the time of the pandemic. Do you see things similarly, and do you have a sense of how the pandemic has affected the momentum or the energy or the speed of deterioration of the relationship?
I have to say, maybe I look at the things a little bit different. I still think you look back 40 years from now, the currently situation in China still have a great change from what 40 years ago. It's different, total different. People, yes, we talk a lot of things, even not publicly. We can talk many things on the social media. Sometimes, yes, later on there will be broke out, but at least we can talk. Also, people can free move to find work. Not like 40 years, you cannot move to any place without permission of government. Now people can move from countryside to get a job in the city without any difficulty. Total different. So I disagree that the term of a failure of engagement. I think engagement is success for both sides. That's one thing. Another thing I agree, as I described, just like every country, China still go a little bit strictly in some way. I can be frankly, in past several years, yes, there may be in some way get back several steps. Something I don't like, that's for sure. But the EU is we, as two countries, you have to set your relationship on some solid base. 40 years, yes, the base is against Soviet Union. 30 years, yes, we have a common interest of business. Now, more complicated. But still, I think US-China have a common ground, which can continue to develop a relationship. Yes, US can criticize some behavior of Chinese government. Yes, US side can disagree some action of Chinese government. But I think these criticism should not be on the base on these two countries. That's my point. Also, I recall that Richard Haass also written the article just after the speech of Pompeo. He basically say, yes, many things we unhappy with China, but these issues have to be resolved by Chinese people. U.S. have no capacity to change internal affairs of China. I think that's also important. Of course, U.S. can keep criticizing, create some environment, let the government, Chinese government, think it over. That's for sure. But you cannot put these on the base for relationship between two countries. I don't know whether you get my point.
Yeah. And I would say symmetrically, no one expects to modify the inside of the United States. You know, the Americans, and I'll cite again Orville Schell. He wrote a book with John DeLury called Wealth and Power. And he said that he felt the Americans were very sensitive to having been the world leader, and they think they should be able to tell everybody how to structure their own society. But he also felt the Chinese, who had suffered the humiliations of the Opium War and the Japanese invasion, would be the country in the world that would be most reluctant to accept such guidance and to reassert the national identity and pride of the country. And so he foresaw, I made a video with him in 2015, and he wrote this book just before that. So 2014, 6 years ago, he was seeing what you might call the psychological tension that would inhibit either side from adjusting too much to acknowledge the other or even accept the partnership of China in the case of the United States. Let me ask you about military-related issues. There's a gentleman who's very famous in the United States, Daniel Ellsberg, who was the person who released during the Vietnam War the Pentagon Papers. And he is an elderly gentleman living in California now, and he's written a book called The Doomsday Machine, where he has said, it, in essence, you're all worried about climate, but the ability to destroy life on Earth, if a conflict arises in the use of nuclear weapons, and he cites three countries as potentially, you know, there could be rogues in many places, but China, the United States, and Russia. And so I'm curious, I read about things in the South China Sea and so forth that are more conventional conflict, but are you fearful that a military conflict of a very large scale could emerge if we don't get back on a cooperative track here in the next few years?
Yes, I don't think large-scale war, including nuclear war, occur immediately. What the most I concern, probably what happened in next 3 months before election in November. First one is by accident, or you call gun is off the file, because recently so many military exercises carry out both sides in South China Sea. So many warships, you know, in and out, aircraft, American aircraft, very close to the coast of China. These things will create a possibility of some a military skirmish. That's one thing. Second is, or someone intentionally try create some military conflict due to domestic political consideration. That's possibility less than the first one. The last one, as you describe, nuclear or large-scale war, I think is still remote at this moment. That's my judgment, three possibilities. Of course, as I said at the beginning, both sides should keep greater restraint on that. If something happened that, it will be disastrous to US, to China, to rest of the world. That's something we should keep in mind. I can tell you, two or three, or maybe 2 months ago, we have do the video conference with Martin Wolf, one of my friends.
Yes.
The FT the audience ask him, what's your estimation of the possibility of the war between U.S. and China? He thought it over. He said, maybe 20%. He said, I just guess. So I just share his thought with you. So I don't know what's the percentage of the possibility, but I just give you the ranking of these kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, how would I say, we've seen, and Martin's family, I know him quite well. They come from parts of Europe that were devastated with the rise of the Nazis. And so in this context, I guess one can imagine things that are almost unimaginable. And so my asking the question related to military was, at some level, I agree with you that the scale, particularly given what they call mutual assured destruction, the way you deter each other, it does not seem likely. It doesn't seem likely until somebody loses their self-control and then ignites something that necessitates a reaction. And Ellsberg is very clear that he would like to see treaties on the massive reduction of nuclear weapons so that all of the planet is in a safer place as we embrace climate and other issues as well. How about with regard to how do you see the challenge of cybersecurity when increasingly people are involved in digital commerce? How will the United States and China be able to coexist in such a world where these cyber systems contain a lot of information that can be used for espionage or military or surveillance purpose?
First of all, I have to admit, I'm not expert on this issue, but I do understand the importance of the issue. Also, the issue, from my perspective, is very complicated. It's very hard to reach agreement between U.S. and China, including Europe. In some way, maybe Europe have a one step ahead. They have some law to protect privacy in data collection. I guess in some ways they in advanced situation. I guess world, including U.S. China, should have some kind of agreement on that. Otherwise, it's very hard to fully use the advantage of ICT technology. But you can see what happened now. The every country, almost every country, use the national security to ban some software of other countries. These tendency has already started to expand. So I worry about at the end we'll become one world, two system. One system may be used by US or some of his allies, another system used by China or some other countries, which I don't think is good for world. So I do think it should have a serious negotiation on that. But I doubt currently is a good time to do that. Probably have to wait until the end of election. Then both sides, whatever, who become the president of the United States, then it's time for them to sit down, to have a look at it carefully, to have a negotiation on some agreement.
I see the Americans blaming what happened in Wuhan, but even my American friends who are expatriate in China are saying they don't want to come home to America because China's handling the experience and the extinguishing of the virus much better than America is.
Okay, my judgment is at the beginning, Chinese side, I guess, not make things straightforward, or I would say made some mistake. Two reasons. One is system, because usually they very close watch. They don't want the bad news out. That's the system. Secondly, this disease is new to everyone. Nobody knows what's going on. Actually, many people think it will provide a good opportunity for US and China work together, but the result is different. I guess it's a complicated issue. Of course, some corner of US totally blame, or even some conspiracy or Chinese government intentionally try to send out a virus abroad. I think it's ridiculous. Nobody can do that. As I say, they do have some shortcoming, but it's definitely no tension can do that and these things. That's first of all. From Chinese side, some corner little overconfidence. Some corner say, oh, that's verify all system is good, is better. That's get backlash from rest of the world, because people are suffering. You cannot always, you know, overconfident. Do you understand that? That's something I guess China should take a lesson for that. I can give you typical example. You know the daughter of Jin Liqing, Jin Keyu, teaching at the in UK. She wrote some article in social media. He say Chinese people should not to overconfident, say to push some system difference. But immediately get a lot of criticism from some Chinese people, which show some nationalism. Even in China, also very high. That kind of things, I guess, both sides. Later on, you know, the Trump at the beginning have called President Xi, praise China, did a good job. But later on, he totally shifted the tone. Called the virus China virus. I get these kind of things from domestic political consideration. That's the basic I describe.
You know, we've talked in this conversation about many, many things, how differences emerged, where people are stubborn, where mistrust perhaps is not accurate, but it's not relinquishing. Our friend Orville Schell, who's worked with us on many U.S.-China events, spoke it or wrote in a recent article called The End of Engagement, from that period where Kissinger and Nixon and Mao met to the present. He had a very pessimistic take on where we are. But I think in talking to you, you had the vision of engagement 2.0. We're gonna reboot the system. And I guess what I want to learn from you in this last part of the conversation is, what can each side contribute? What can the Americans, what can the West contribute? What can the Chinese contribute? What do you dread and what do you hope for?
Okay. Yes, I guess the term engagement point out the two is the exact term I want to describe the relationship between these two countries in near future. I hope, first of all, I don't see any military conflict, no matter it is intentionally or intentionally, which I guess it will be disaster to everyone. Secondly, I do hope both sides can revolt or establish normal relationship with some kind of competition and some kind of cooperation. Obviously, the competition is inevitable, but I hope it can be under the control, not go to the down, to the worst. For US side, I hope the judgment for the engagement still should be seriously discussed. Personally, I disagree with the judgment. The engagement, previous engagement, has been failure. I disagree with that, but I hope U.S. side, no matter academic or government, can discuss it seriously. For Chinese side, I do hope they should make kind of judgment, a re-judgment or restriction. They should make good balance between the resource used overseas and domestically. But still, you know, although in past 40 years, China achieved tremendous achievement, but still some or many Chinese people, particularly in countryside and in western part of China, are still in kind of poverty, or at least not like life in large city. I hope Chinese side can continue to move to eliminate the poverty, to promote the life standard of middle class people. Also politically, they should be more tolerant to some difference, different point of view. I guess at this moment, I guess the first thing both sides can do is continue to carry out the first phase of a trade agreement. No matter some people claim some shortcoming of the trade agreement, but at least it's the start point. Both sides can use that as a starting point to improve the relationship down the road. That's my my thinking.
I think the other thing that probably weighs in this is that we're on the cusp of the U.S. presidential election in November, and the demonization of others, meaning foreign countries or other races other than white, tend to increase in the turmoil that precedes an election. And after someone new is elected, they look around the world and they look for partners and ways to have a win-win game and to collaborate and cooperate, and the tensions diminish somewhat. At this juncture, most of the polls indicate that the Democratic Party under Joe Biden is more likely to win than Donald Trump, and that may take some of the acrimony and tension out of the system, but we'll just have to wait and see. I think in some ways both parties in America have been expressing frustration in these last 3 or 4 years. So I wouldn't put it all on Donald Trump's back. But I think your exploration of what goes on in China and what you hope for them
is also very, very important. And obviously, with the tremendous human and health costs of something like a nuclear confrontation, we do have to pray that the military, what you might call escalation, is something that both sides will have good enough sense to avoid engaging in. And lastly, as you and I talked about a little bit earlier in this conversation, climate change is a very good place for the U.S. and China to set off on a cooperative path. And sometimes we experience learning by doing, by trying to cooperate, by doing so, by seeing both sides better off. It teaches us to try again and again and again. And that may be the pathway towards healing the rifts that have emerged in recent years. So I guess I look forward to when the pandemic lifts and I can travel back to see you.
Sure.
Or when you can come to New York or Washington.
Yeah.
But I do very much welcome, I'm very grateful that you took the time at this point to explore these issues with me. And I hope before too much time passes, you'll come back on this podcast and we can take the temperature of where we are and maybe talk about engagement 3.0. Well, thank you again for being a part of this podcast series. And I look forward to your work and your research and your friendship. And again, and all, like I said before, the next time we get to talk for this audience. Thanks all for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.